As far as the ass business, getting your butt fucked is one of the great pleasures and privileges of being gay. If you haven't experienced it yourself, I recommend it.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still queer as folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about the penultimate episode of season 4, and it's called Proposal of Two Kinds. It's episode 13 of season 4.
It first aired in the U.S. on July 11th, 2004. It was written by Sean Postoff, his fifth of seven episodes. He also served as story editor for 14 episodes.
Proposal of Two Kinds was directed by Michael DiCarlo, his ninth of 11 episodes. DiCarlo also directed season 2's The Leper, Half the Babe Not Eyes. That was written by Blair Fell, who appeared on this podcast in season 2, episode 7, if you want to check that out.
Yes, it was a lovely chat. Here is the synopsis of Proposal of Two Kinds. Melanie and Lindsay reach a breaking point and decide that they will split up after the baby is born.
Brian continues his late night workouts and is discovered by Justin's detective work. Having to choose between Rage being made into a movie and going on the Liberty ride with Brian, Justin chooses fame and fortune.
Carl proposes to Debbie and Ben proposes to Michael. After a quick wedding in Toronto, emphasis on quick, Ben, Michael, and the rest of gay Pittsburgh kick off the Liberty ride.
Interestingly, in this episode, Hunter seems to have been cured of his nobody will love me syndrome from last episode. He was like completely normal and happy and telling jokes. What happened?
Well, teenagers bounce quick from heartbreak. Plus, it's been like 3 weeks, so more than enough time for him to get over it.
Well, and Drew Boyd, I guess, really did take the hint because he disappeared. He's not even in this episode, which was too bad, actually. Not even mentioned.
No, not at all.
This got me thinking about something I said last episode, and that was how Emmett broke things off with Drew because he couldn't see somebody that wasn't out and open about their sexuality. But what about George Schickel? Emmett fell for a closeted gay man back then and happily supported him as he came out and found his way in the world as an out and proud rich gay man. So I think Emmett contradicted himself a little bit in that last episode with Drew Boyd.
But George Schickel was willing to take that step out.
He wasn't at first, though. Remember when, well, barely. As soon as they went to that opera that one night, it was all over.
Yes.
He was out and
proud. It was all over.
Right.
So at that point, there was no turning back. And George was willing to be like, all right, well, time to get busy living or die trying, which we saw what happened. So
it seems like the same story, kind of the way that, remember, George felt that he had so much to lose by being out. And then his wife had drove him out of Schickel's pickles and he was living a recluse life. And so that's sort of what Drew is afraid of here, is that if he came out, he would end up like a George Schickel.
I mean, that is very true. Of course, does Drew Boyd even know about George Schickel?
Nobody knows about George Schickel anymore. He's never brought up, which is terrible.
Yeah, especially considering how much I think a lot of fans love that storyline.
We love that story too.
Yeah, this show doesn't like to recall the past unless it becomes relatively convenient to do so.
Or unless they would like to directly contradict it.
Yes.
So this episode was kind of a collection of runners. There was a lot of little stories going on, and the only real kind of main story that seemed to be happening was Melanie and Lindsay. So I gave that the A story, and I gave everything else in the episode the status of runners. So
yes, I mean, I had to think about how to break up the stories because I was having that same issue in terms of what to give an A and a B story in runners. So I just sort of broke it up by the events of this episode, which is everyone dealing with the Liberty ride, and then Mel and Lens, and then Justin and Rage. So if I have to jump around in my notes to go along with this, bear with me.
We've seen this before in these final episodes of a season where the writing staff is trying to stitch together all sorts of stories and either end them or set them up to continue into the next season, almost as if they aren't quite sure if they're going to come back next season. So it's like, let's wrap these up somehow.
Yeah, let's make sure as many things have a nice little bow at the end, just in case.
Right. So Melanie is getting very bossy, cunty even.
Before you go, could you bring me some tea and maybe some peach yogurt and a couple of cookies? And go upstairs and get me my maroon cardigan. I'm a little chilly.
Anything else?
Another blanket and a firmer pillow. And as long as you're out, I need a roll of stamps, as well as these things from the pharmacy. I'm not allowed to move. What the hell else am I supposed to do?
You might try saying please and stop treating me like the hired help, which actually wouldn't be so bad. At least I'd get paid.
Sorry, but it's your child too.
That still doesn't give you the right to order me around.
I wasn't ordering you. You have a hell of a nerve talking to me about rights. You had no right to—
Okay!
She is a raging bitch to Lindsay with all of her little demands. I would like to think that if I was in that position, that I would preface my asks with something like, I'm so sorry, babe. Could you possibly get my cardigan next time you're upstairs?
No, that's a very excellent point, because I think it starts out that way where she's like, oh, I don't want to inconvenience you, but could you give me a couple of snacks?
And some stamps.
Oh, and then, yeah, well, no, and then like, since you're up, can you possibly, you know, grab that, my cardigan, because I'm chilly. Oh, but then also, could you go ahead and get this laundry list of stuff? Thank you so much. And I'm kind of curious to know what you think of this. Did you have a feeling like Melanie spilled the beans and what Lindsay did? Because I had a feeling when the people at the center said bye to Lindsay, they like gave her a cold ass shoulder.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. I just thought it was them sort of looking at Lindsay going, weren't you helping?
No, there was something about it. Like as soon as Lindsay entered the room, the one woman like turned, looked at her up and down like, bitch, and like walked out. It's like, we gotta go. It's like, woof.
Oh yeah, that was Tanis. Remember Tanis?
Yeah. Oh yes, Tanis. It was Tanis. Tanis looked like she was done with Lindsay the second Lindsay stepped in. I feel like Melanie was like ready to turn people against Lindsay.
I can believe it, because this scene with the lesbians seems somehow out of sync with reality. We keep picking apart like little things that don't seem quite right with it. So I wonder if these scripts were kind of stitched together, and maybe it's even shot out of sequence. And this episode that we're seeing here is just kind of the collection of footage that was left over.
It almost feels like the lesbian storyline is the interlude to everything else in the show. Like, and now for a Melanie and Lindsay interlude. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Here's 30 seconds of them bitching at each other. Now back to the main story.
Melanie tells Lindsay that she has no right. I wonder what the next line to that would have been, because Lindsay interrupted her. She has no right to what? No right to have sex with a man, maybe? Or I don't know where that line was going. It was like one of those lines that was made to be cut off when in fact the writer never had a clear idea what the full line really was.
I don't have a place for you to go to with this, so make sure you really cut her off at this point.
Right.
I mean... I see that in plays all the time. A lot of times, especially contemporary writers have gotten really specific in terms of like, this is where dialogue is supposed to overlap and this is where dialogue is supposed to be cut off. So I've had to take it as a director to say, okay, I hope you have something ready to continue on in case they don't cut you off.
Right. They missed their cue.
Right. But then it becomes a game of like, okay, I have to make sure that the character that's supposed to cut this person off has gotten there in an action level in order to justify why they're cutting them off. Like, what is it about this sentence that's about to make them snap? So like,
that was missing here.
Yes, exactly.
This interplay between them, I think, might have been more interesting if it had just sort of devolved over a longer period of time, where Lindsay like stopped taking the high road and instead was kind of passive aggressive or subtly refusing to do what Melanie said. But instead, it's like one list of demands, bam, flip the switch.
I'm done. Why are you bossing me around? It's like, well, first of all, Lindsay, she does have a point that she is on bed rest and she's not supposed to do all this stuff, and she is still trying to take care of the home. Where, like,
yeah, where's Gus?
Right,
who's taking care of Gus during all this?
Gus is still in like daycare 3 days ago or something, like, who knows where he is. That is I understand that obviously Melanie is getting like slight revenge and making her just do a lot. I think it was most obvious when she pulled out the list. It was like, okay, I see what you're getting at. But like Lindsay seemed like upset that she was going to have to go and get the cardigan.
Yeah.
Like it felt like she had enough there.
I don't want to go up the stairs. Get stuff from the kitchen. Fine.
Be cold.
Right. So Lindsay says that she's going to take Gus to the park. And then we see Lindsay and Brian with Gus, clearly not at the park. They were at some sort of like indoor recreational facility. I don't know where they went, but it wasn't a park.
No, it was. I thought that we were just like leaving. Again, I think they just left Gus at daycare and thought, oh, we got to pick him up. But let's have this conversation first. And I think it's fascinating that they've reintroduced that whole idea that Lindsay could go to Brian for these problems. We had it early in the season and they sort of just dropped that as a dramatic device. And now they're bringing it back.
Yeah, I just wish that these interactions with Brian would be a little less catty and a little more loving and caring, because we've seen sort of a closer relationship between the two of them in the past where they can be vulnerable with each other. That's just kind of lost here. And it would have been maybe even a lot better if Brian had told Lindsay that he had testicular cancer, for example, something to build up this vulnerable relationship between them. But here, Brian is just kind of like the usual dick that he always is. He pulled out Marguerite Kammermeier.
So now you have to serve in silence like that muncher in the military, Greta Kammermeier.
Margaret Kammermeier. And I don't know how much longer I can put up with it.
I had to look her up. Did you know who she was?
No.
She was a colonel in the Washington National Guard who came out as a lesbian when asked during a routine military security screening thing in like 1989. She was also then kicked out of the National Guard, promptly sued them and won. And that was one of the first cases of a court saying that it's unconstitutional to bar gays and lesbians from serving in the military. There was also a 1995 made-for-TV movie called Serving in Silence, the Marguerite Kammermeier story, and it starred Glenn Close and Judy Davis.
Ooh, I like that cast.
Yeah, so how did Brian drop this in? How did he just pull this out of thin air?
Yeah, it's quite... for someone who I don't think really cared a whole lot about lesbian...
Exactly.
...history, for him to pull that out is a pretty good one. Unless that TV movie was a huge hit and we just don't know it.
Well, I thought maybe Cohen and Lipman had something to do with that, but they didn't. They
weren't so on it was the a shameless list. Plug.
I don't know. So Melanie takes it upon herself to just leave the house, and she goes to that Liberty Ride departure event. Lindsay is rightfully beside herself.
Where the fuck have you been? I come home. You're not here. I look everywhere, frantic. I was about to call the hospital, the police, the morgue. I thought something terrible had happened.
Would you calm down?
No, I will not calm down. You scared the shit out of me.
Sorry.
I can tell.
I went to the Liberty Ride send-off.
Why would you do that? After everyone told you, despite me.
That was a seriously cunt move on Melanie's part to just leave the house and not leave like a note or anything. She was just like gone when Lindsay got back.
And it's a dangerous thing for her health. Like the doctor is telling her, you must stay in bed because you went into pre-labor. And so just to give the middle finger to Lindsay, she's not even going to tell her. Like that was seriously fucked up.
Yeah, I'm not sure where this writing is going. Is she just trying to provoke Lindsay into leaving? Is she trying to get revenge? What are the writers telling us here?
Absolutely. I think it is absolutely. You are on the money in that she's just trying to force Lindsay's hand because...
You can't fire me, I quit type of thing?
I feel like it is... This happens a lot in relationships where one part of the couple is not happy, but rather than own up to it and have that conversation, you drag it on and then you change behaviors to where it feels like you're doing everything to make the other one miserable, or you are extra mean to them, or you're doing everything to like make them do it rather than you do it. And it's just, it was such a bitch move to pull, because like, even when Lindsay's is visibly upset and saying, where the fuck have you been? I called here. I thought you could have, like, I thought something happened. I thought you went to the hospital. I even called the morgue. Like, you could tell that she was distraught over this. And there's Melanie just rolling up her sleeves going, calm down. And you're like, bitch.
But I'm not sure what Melanie's obstruction is here. Where is she headed? And what is standing in her way to get there? It's unclear what's going on with this character.
That's the thing. Like, you would think someone who has built her life as an attorney would know how to
Oh, yeah, she's an attorney.
Right. Who's someone who could articulate the points of her argument to say, here is why I am still upset, and here is why this is clearly not working. This is it. But no, Melanie is just being vengeful and cruel. And like, I understand that Lindsay cheated. Get it. I get it. Not to mention that it was with a man, which I think that was the most egregious part to Melanie.
Yeah.
But Melanie, own up to it. If you're like, I can't forgive you for that, then great. Now you know where you have to go with it. Now you know that you clearly cannot continue to be together, because to then just completely denigrate your partner that way, you're never going to get out of it.
She succeeds in chasing Lindsay away. But if she really wanted to split, then why all the theatrics and histrionic behavior? Why not just say so?
100%. I don't get it. Yeah, exactly. Saying like, you know what? I can never forgive you for this. So
right.
let's now realize that we have to move on from each other. I know who I am. I think you still need to figure out who you are. Let's end this.
And granted, that's a tough conversation to have and something tough to bring up, but she just seems so contrived and so fake. Apparently it works, and she succeeds in chasing Lindsay away. And then she seemed almost a little like, oh, shit.
See, I read that reaction in Lindsay more than Melanie, because I think here's Lindsay saying what needs to be said, that we need to be apart. And then Mel agrees. And for me, Lindsay was saying like, oh, you do? You really do want to end this?
Sort of like one of those tough conversations where you're not happy at work and you tell your boss you're thinking of leaving, and they're like, well, let's figure out a good exit for you. Instead of them saying like,
you're like, wait a minute,
we really want you to stay.
You're not going to fight for me. Right. I think that was the thing. Like she was willing to fight against her, but not to fight for her. It seems impossible. I do have to mention very quickly, though, before we wrap up Melanie and Lindsay, is that I caught 3 theater specific references.
Oh, really?
In this final fight. First of all, Melanie calls her a Shiksa goddess.
Well, guess what, my Shiksa goddess?
You don't call me that.
This time it isn't about you. It's about me.
Which is overall is a general term for in you know, the Jewish community, but I know it specifically as a song from the last 5 years musical. But so she calls her a Shiksa goddess, which that is it's a term for a woman who is basically non-Jewish, that Jewish men, and in this case women, sort of gravitate towards in attractiveness because they're everything that they're not supposed to have. So that's one. And the second one is when she talks about how she was fine after leaving the house and coming back, oh, miracle of miracles, which is from Fiddler on the Roof, sung by Model. And then there was that when Lindsay's like making her stand and she says that we can't be the female version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is the famous play. And I'm just like, wow, y'all threw those in, I think, just for me. Like, I was like, oh, I know where each of these are coming from.
There was one more that maybe you didn't pick up on, and that's Monty Python's Life of Brian. Melanie talks about spending all of her time in bed as living the life of Brian.
Oh, I thought she was making a joke about our Brian, like Brian Kinney, and that he spends all of his time in bed. That's how I took it.
So, of course, folks, stick around. We got a lot more to talk about tonight. So our first runner of this episode, of which I marked out 5, and this is the shortest one. So maybe this is more about characters. So Brian had probably the least important role in this entire episode. The episode opens up with Brian sneaking out to go work out, and Justin is tailing him through a very film noir Pittsburgh back alley, complete with smoke and steam and
saxophone music and yeah. The Dutch angles and the shadow play, the close up on Justin's eyes as he's watching him sneak out.
I liked it, but it was just so like pointless.
It was a little too cutesy. Like, look what we can do.
Well, there is that, and the fact that, I mean, this wasn't like this great big secret. Justin did not work very hard to find out where Brian was going in the middle of the night, and apparently he's been going there spinning in secret for 3 weeks. Couldn't Justin have just asked him, like, dude, where the fuck did you go last night? He has to, like, go tail him? He has to, like, wake up in the middle of the night? have a grown-up conversation.
And then he also just didn't seem that surprised.
Right. Like, it's like, I knew it all along.
You've been going to the spin class in the middle of the night. Somehow you have... I'd be like, how did you get access to this gym in the middle of the night?
How did Justin get in when he got there? Doesn't Brian lock the door behind him?
Well, he clearly doesn't lock the door to his own building. So, like, why would he even lock the building of the gym?
It's funny because I like this scene. And I like that hookup they had in the Soul Cycle.
I thought that was one of the hottest seduction scenes we've seen in a very long time.
Yes, definitely.
And then we've watched Drew Boyd fuck Emmett. And so, like, that's saying a lot.
This was more sensual and seductive, whereas Drew Boyd was just pounding the hell out of Emmett
to score that touchdown
with his 10-inch dick.
10-inch dick.
For the rest of the show, though, Brian just really had no lines. He was just sort of like popping in and kind of and then like popping out. He had like a small role in the Michael and Ben story. So let's talk about that next runner.
Okay.
So first of all, Ben proposes on a school bus.
Michael Novotny, you are the man I've been looking for all my life. I am so very blessed to have found you, which is why I'm asking you to do me the honor of accepting my hand in marriage.
So that was cute and campy, but I wish that Hunter would have been in the background of that shot and taken notice, though. I feel like Hunter is forever being marginalized as a member of the family. He's like an... like an also type of thing. He's never really integrated.
Well, I was surprised when we go after the seduction of Justin and Brian, and then it cuts into the class during the day to see Hunter was going to be training too.
Yep, right.
Like, wait a minute. When did he get invited? Is he old enough to go on this cross country trip? I don't understand. Like, where did that come from?
How old is he now? He's
16? No.
16, because remember 16. Callie's dad said they're 16.
Yeah, they're 16. Yeah. Yes. So 16. And yeah, so he's gonna do this giant ride with them.
Right.
And I was like, also, just the having done stadium cycling before, I found it was semi-accurate. Like the instructor like counting into the rhythm and all the grunting and like the, yeah, let's go.
Yeah. I thought it was weird that it was Ben though, that was doing that. Like the one guy in the class that's probably in the best shape. And he's the one that seems like the most like licked by it all.
Yeah. That was very, Hunter didn't look like he was breaking a sweat. He's like, what? Like it's hard. Did you know that the spin instructor is played by Stephen Amell, who is the Green Arrow on the CW?
Really?
Yeah.
Why couldn't Brian have hooked up with him?
I was waiting on it. I was waiting for it. But yeah, I found that very funny when I was going through the IMDb page. I was like, wait a minute. That's the Green Arrow. He is quite the ally. And check out his Instagram.
So the gang arrives on the school bus in Toronto. And then the gang hits Church Street, which is the template for Liberty Avenue in Pittsburgh. And I hate inside jokes in episodic TV. I don't know why the writers thought that they had to do this, maybe as some kind of an homage to Church Street.
So I know it clearly bothered you that they were mocking that everything looks familiar as it does in Pittsburgh because, you know, it's the same set. I'm glad they put that in there because I think it would have been so dumb to not acknowledge that this is clearly the same set. Like it was so obviously the same set.
How about use a different set?
Okay, you're acting like they had a budget for season 4. I'm glad they acknowledged it because if they didn't, I would have been like, are you going to tell me that we're all just going to pretend that this isn't just the same entrance that you use for Woody's? Like, I would have been mad that they didn't acknowledge it. So I think we're on opposite ends of the spectrum here.
Yeah, I mean, they really didn't have to be at a bar to begin with, though, for what happened in the bar. Well, I guess they did for that stag party, but for like the important conversation between Brian and Michael, that could have happened anywhere. That could have happened on the bus, right?
True. Very true.
Season 1 of Queer as Folk was shot in the real Woody's in Toronto, but after that they rebuilt it on a soundstage. So it wasn't even the real Woody's to begin with. It was the exterior. So inside Woody's, there's a Moosey's? Moosey's. There's a
Moose Woody's. Yeah. Woody's.
Well, the real one in Moosey's. Toronto, the bar next door, which is actually connected, is called Sailor. So it's Woody's and Sailor. It's two bars, but two entrances, but one inside bar.
Ah.
So inside there's a stag party going on, and this was okay, an okay backdrop to the Ben and Michael marriage story, and Brian's inevitable weighing in on it.
Well, what's stopping you? Besides the fact that it's the most pathetic idea I've ever heard.
It just so happens that a lot of gay men want to get married.
Darling, have you seen them? And since when did you ever have the least interest in getting married?
I didn't. But not because I didn't want to, but because I never thought I could. It wasn't a story I told myself like straight kids did, you know, that someday I'd meet that special person and we'd fall in love and have a big wedding. It was never real for me.
So Brian is, of course, opposed to Michael getting married. This scene was kind of curious, though. Was Brian jealous of Michael considering marriage, or was he jealous that Michael may not be holding out forever for Brian? I'm not sure what was important in this scene.
I think for Brian has been set up as that character who speaks purely and only to the gay male experience, that to see someone yearn for something that is heteronormative, like finding that monogamous partner and being married and having children and settling down, doesn't compute with him. He feels like that's the complete opposite of what it means to be a gay man. Like, that's why he argues that it's our God-given right to fuck whoever we want, whenever we want. And when you get married, you can't have that. And,
sure you can.
But exactly. Like, not, you absolutely can. Like, we know today that you can have the husband in the beautiful house with the 2.5 children and then have, you know, a sex dungeon underneath it all. Like, right. It's totally possible.
Or it could be those two guys that Emmett was the naked maid for, right? They were married.
Exactly. It was all just like a little bit of fun to keep things spicy.
Something that Brian said kind of confounded me.
And since when did you ever have the least interest in getting married?
But what about that guy that he was all but married to named Dr. David Cameron, and he was enjoying being a wife?
He was going to move away.
He did move away.
He did move away.
He was all in on that for a while. He's all about being married. So,
and be the stepdad to JT York? I mean, yeah, he was ready to do it.
Hank. You got JT York on your mind.
He's always going to be JT York.
So speaking of marriage equality, this wedding of theirs, what is it about Queer as Folk and really, really awful weddings? Remember Melanie and Lindsay's wedding? This one was just as bad.
I thought this was worse.
Well, here we have another massive moment in the series and the lives of two major characters. It went from proposal to wedding vows in less than 8 minutes of screen time. And then there's a shitty wedding in a Las Vegas style Toronto venue with a whole bunch of people in the audience that we have never, ever seen.
Who were those other people? Do you think that's just their job? Like, to be the witnesses?
Yeah. I need 30 witnesses for this wedding. Round them up.
Okay. You, and you. Great. Come on in. Like, they weren't even like, they were just wearing dress shirts.
I thought maybe all these people had gone on the Liberty ride, but then, well, gee, I guess they brought formal clothes with them too for the wedding instead of like their spandex and Lycra. It's like, how did this happen?
This whole wedding made no damn sense to me whatsoever.
Do you, Michael, promise to love, respect, and cherish Ben and be his true and faithful husband?
I do.
And do you, Ben, promise to love, respect, and cherish Michael, and be his true and faithful husband?
Say I do, dude.
I do.
If anyone knows of any reason why these two people should not be joined in marriage, speak now or forever hold your peace.
You say one word, you can be holding more than your peace.
Now, by the authority of the province of Ontario, I pronounce you to be legally married.
It should have been a much bigger deal for Michael and Ben in the overall story arc. Instead, it was just like a lark.
It's like they decided one Tuesday afternoon.
Let's get married with bottle caps or something. Okay, next runner. This is like the Endless Runner show.
Seriously.
Let's talk about Emmett and Ted. Ted starts to have triggers in spin class when two hunky guys are talking about the ride and bringing their crystal meth with them.
Hey, there's supposed to be some really hot guys riding.
That's what I heard.
A friend of mine went on a ride last year, said at night, the showers get really steamy.
And he wasn't talking about the water. Bringing anything with you that starts with a C?
You mean my vitamins? You know me, never leave home without them.
Of course you're going to bring crystal meth with you if you're going on a 400-mile bike ride, right?
What? Like, at first I thought, I like that you used the word triggering because I thought, is he just hearing things? Like, I understand they said, like, there's the parties can be pretty intense or pretty steamy. Sure. Totally get it. But you're going to tell me that it turns into a crystal party? And if this is a well-known thing, why was Ted supporting it from the beginning?
Yeah, and of course, if you're going to do a bunch of crystal, the first thing you want to do is get on a bike, right?
Yes, exactly. Hold on, let me light up real quick before doing the next leg of this trip. Come on.
Yeah, these hot, in-shape guys in spin class we're supposed to think are Tina addicts, and they're going to go on a physically challenging cross-country bike ride. This was only there to set up Ted bringing Emmett on the ride. So I can think of a number of reasons why Emmett should go on the ride other than Ted's resurgent addiction and worried about the hunky guys with their bag of Tina.
Yeah, it's going to be, hey, Emmett, I know you're still distraught over Drew and having to end things. Come on the ride with us. It'll do you a lot of good.
Yeah.
The end.
Exactly.
Why are you going to...
Why bring Ted into this? He's doing so well.
He's been through enough.
So
let him be.
Well, then he bails on the ride. And at first I was annoyed that Ted's substance abuse problem just came out of nowhere after so many episodes of him acting like nothing had happened. I think the last time we had any real reason to believe that he was a meth addict was maybe one or two episodes ago where he kind of mentioned it in passing. And before that, he was a singing waiter. That's okay, though, because most substance abuse people in recovery are just a moment away from relapsing. So the story kind of started to make sense, but...
I think if they had put more of that worry in like the previous episodes as they're talking about the Liberty Ride, like if we had known during the even like the fundraiser that things have been known to get wild at, you know, at the Liberty Ride.
Yeah.
Okay. But no, but Ted will be fine. And then we can see that build up to this point. And then he hears directly that, oh no, it can go into like full crystal kind of world. Then we understand why he's nervous about doing it. But just to drop it in this episode,
bam,
does not earn itself to the story.
There's another question I have about Ted. Why does he have a cat now?
Emmett had the same question.
Lupe. Come out, Lupe. Come on, puss. Be a good puss. Come on now. Come on, puss, puss.
Who are you talking to?
Lupe.
Come on, puss, 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 puss. Yeah, your cleaning lady's never going to come out if you talk to her like that.
Lupe's my cat.
You got a cat?
First of all, he assumed that Lupe was his cleaning lady, which, wow.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Emmett. And, but then he said
what was this for? Why was this here?
I don't. To have some sort of companionship, knowing that he can't really be with a man. He can't trust himself to be with a man. So it's kind of like how, like, people don't know if they can be in a relationship. So they start off by taking care of a plant, and then they take care of an animal, and then they continue on and on. Maybe that's what it was.
I am pretty sure that we never ever see or hear of this cat again.
Really? This was the beginning and the end for Lupe the cat?
I think so. I can't remember another story with Lupe.
It's like they didn't even have it in the budget to get the animal itself.
Yeah, right.
So they just say, like, the cat went missing.
The cat escaped.
Great. I could just see... I can see Scott Lowell talking with the writers in the script where, like, so it says that I have a cat? So when did I get this cat? Like, okay, so we're just saying that you had a cat. Don't worry. It's not in the budget. We couldn't get the actual animal trainers, none of that. So the cat's already going to go missing. Okay, great. And then we won't worry about it anymore.
Yeah, never mention it again. I had another question about Ted. Why was he late to leave for Toronto?
Was he deciding up until the very, very, very last minute?
Yeah, after he convinces Emmett to go on the ride, he's just like gonna bail.
And of course, well, and here's the thing though, by having him be late to it as they're about to drive off, when we've already had like another reason why they were about to be late and drive off, like it sort of then diminished the previous moment. So I'm like, It felt like the multiple endings to The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, let's just get this show on the goddamn road. Let's go.
It was just so pointless. He jumps in front of the bus. Stop the fucking
bus! Like, really?
Why not just have Ted being reluctant and Emmett helping him? I mean, why is he late? Why does he have a cat? Why is he jumping in front of the bus?
The drama of it all.
It was bad drama. There's one good thing about this scene, though, is did you notice Hunter's seatmate on the bus?
No, I didn't.
Now, it wasn't the actor that I'm about to say, but this guy was a spinning image for Ian Somerhalder, like a young Ian Somerhalder, even pre-Lost. Because remember, Ian Somerhalder was he played Boone on Lost.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And then he was in the Rules of Attraction. That Brett Easton
Ellis
film.
I can never forget him in Rules of Attraction.
Oh, and plus that scene in the bedroom where they're dancing to
in their underwear.
Yeah.
You know, that movie is pure chaos, but I will watch it when it's on.
Oh, I will too. I first saw Ian Somerhalder in 2000. He was on this WB show called Young Americans. It was like one of those midsummer things that's presented by Coca-Cola. Oh. It was really good. And interestingly enough, though, Charlie Hunnam was a guest star on Young Americans.
Oh.
And of course, he played Nathan Maloney in the original Queer as Folk UK series. It wasn't Ian Somerhalder, though, but I looked at this guy and I looked at him. I'm like, why is Hunter standing next to Ian Somerhalder on the bus to Toronto?
When did he become a guest star?
Right.
I am literally like watching the tape now because I really need to see this for myself. Because I would have picked up on that right away.
I mean, it's a terrible extra. There's like all this conversation going on around him, and he's just kind of looking out the window, like past everybody, 1,000-yard stare, and just not even paying attention to anything that's happening.
Okay, I kind of see it.
Yeah, like a 15-year-old Ian Somerhalder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Still Queer as Folk, season 4, episode 13. We'll be right back. Okay, runner number, what is this?
3,417, yeah.
Debbie and Carl. So Carl shows up at Red Cape Comics and asks Michael for Debbie's hand.
What I'm trying to say is I need someone in my life who will make me laugh, who'll make me feel good.
I'm already taken, Carl.
That's why I want to marry your mother.
I thought that was cute that he thought enough to ask Michael that. But what I didn't think was cute was when Carl comes in and kicks Justin out of Michael's shop.
First of all, I think Justin can be a blabbermouth.
True, but Justin was on his way out the door anyway, so why not just let him exit the scene? It was just like this wordy writing like, Justin, can you excuse us? Like, Justin, get the fuck out. It's like they didn't need to just bounce Justin out of the scene. They could have just left him there. He's already leaving. Just let him leaving.
Be like, maybe to it. But I thought it was really sweet. And really cute. I like Carl.
I did too. Do you remember when Michael used to hate Carl though?
Because he was a cop.
Yeah, and he even spent the night in jail over him. Remember that episode? After all that, I thought his question to Carl was pretty meh.
But in your case, I only have one question. Do you promise you'll be good to her?
I give you my word.
Then the answer is you may.
Maybe a better question from Michael would have been, do you love her? Or something like that. Not like, will you be good to her? Will you give her a good home?
I think Michael would have to assume that if he's willing to ask for her hand in marriage, that he does love her.
Mm. Okay.
And I just, you know, we know that there is, I wasn't bothered by that. And I
are you
going
to be good
sweet.
To her? Well, not really.
Like, is he going to treat her right? Is he going to treat her right? You know, I think that works for me.
Is somebody like Carl actually going to tell Michael not what he wants to hear?
I found it sweet, so I'm not gonna fight what you had on it. You're not gonna change my mind about it.
I like Carl's part. I liked everything that Carl was doing. I just thought Michael was, once again, just kind of like a buffoon.
I would never have thought that Carl would ask Michael's permission. So how is someone, Michael, what would Michael do in that moment? Which is, I think he is trying to act as a protector. I don't think he's that great at it, but he knows that Carl clearly cares for his mom and Debbie loves him. But my big thing was, have we missed that Debbie and Horvath got back together?
No, we never really saw that.
I was going to say, because the last thing I clearly remember was Debbie going to the policeman's ball,
right,
and Horvath was with another woman.
And then Horvath brought her a melon. And then apparently things took off from there because...
Right, because then 3 weeks later, he's ready to propose to her?
Well, he does say to Michael that he's spending a lot of time with her. So maybe a lot of time passed, or maybe...
3 weeks. It was said in the episode, it's been 3 weeks since the actions of the last episode. So I'm like, oh, what?
Yeah. Okay, final runner of the night, Justin and Rage. This might have actually been the B story if it had more screen time, because it did have some meat to it. Brett Keller is back. There's a quick exterior shot here that really, really, really made me roll my eyes. That's of Brett Keller's house, and it's probably the worst compositing shot in this entire show. It was distinctly Hawaiian in design and in the mountain. It's set at the bottom of a generic mountain with a fake Hollywood sign, and even the palm trees were fake, and the clouds were moving at like 100 miles an hour over the top of the mountain. To make matters worse, in Brett Keller's driveway is a busted up Chevy SUV. So, okay, we need an establishing shot to say we are now in California, but they blew it here.
Of all the houses in the Hollywood Hills to use, why that one?
This isn't the house of the hottest Hollywood director. And I think Michael DiCarlo just overplayed this. We know that he's a successful film director. We don't even need this exterior that somebody stitched together in Photoshop.
Okay, so while you rolled your eyes at the exterior, I rolled my eyes at the interior. When what we're treated with is the words happy birthday spelled out in cocaine.
And not just like a little thin line. That was like
calligraphy that happened.
And that was a really thick line. That had to have been like a kilo of cocaine. It's like Scarface all of a sudden.
Scarface is like, hold on, that's a little much even for me. Like, come on, really?
Oh, and by the way, that was a totally different house that he was in on the inside. It didn't match the exterior from that terrible composite.
I'm glad you said this, because I think it was the editing of that moment where I thought, oh, this was the party that Ted was worried about going to and experiencing. Oh, no, wait, that's Brett Keller. Wait a minute. We're in Hollywood, not in Canada. Wait a minute. What just happened? I was thrown off completely.
Well, is all this supposed to just scream Hollywood to us? It's like fast living, drugs, A-list celebrities, questionable
drugs,
private
and rock
lives,
and roll and all that.
Justin's all wide-eyed by it. It is also a bit hard to believe that Justin would just pick the ride over going to L.A. to pitch his career ambition.
Michael told me you're winging to the coast tomorrow to huddle with studio heads.
I never said I was going.
He seems to think that you are.
Well, I'm not. We're going on the ride together as planned.
Well, unfortunately, there's been a slight change of plans. I'm not going.
Why the fuck not?
Because you're right. I'm not in good enough shape.
I saw you cycling.
Yeah, and after 30 miles, I was winded. On the ride, we're going to have to do 80 to 100 miles a day, maybe more. There's no way I can make it.
That is bullshit. You're just saying that to get me to go to Hollywood.
Go on the ride without me. Sacrifice your future. Now that's what I call charity.
Yeah, that's a little surprising to me. That doesn't seem like a Justin move.
No, I think that is a Justin move.
I think so?
That speaks to his. I think so. I think he has this dedication to Brian that again speaks to his youthfulness. And that, no, my partner is the most important thing. But your partner is saying, like, you could have a Hollywood dream. Go do that.
But didn't he learn anything from this man that he worships? Because Brian, remember when Brian like flew to Chicago to pitch Brown Athletics one time instead of going snowboarding with Justin?
I mean, come on.
Okay, so new character comes on the scene, Connor.
This is Justin Taylor. He created Rage.
Let me tell you, Brett's obsessed with your comic.
Justin, this is Connor James.
No, no.
He calls himself an actor.
A few others do too, including me. I think you're great.
Thanks. What would you think of Con for Rage?
You would be wonderful.
Give me a script when you have it.
Who is this character based on? Do you think that there's an analog to a real celebrity? Like, we've talked about how Brett Keller kind of seems like a Bryan Singer in terms of like the party he's throwing and the films that he's directing. Do you think this character matched up with anybody?
Absolutely. But I'm hesitant to say names in case litigation comes about.
Why?
But I have some names.
Give me a name.
Tom Cruise.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could see that. Could have given him darker hair though, right?
Well, I think they were going for someone who is conventionally attractive, clearly an action star, who has been known to be quite the ladies' man to the public. But then what do we discover about Mr. Connor?
We didn't discover anything yet. You can make out with anybody, right? So the studio meeting, I'm starting to think that Brett Keller is like just really annoying.
Agreed. The way he tries to... He's trying to command that meeting by demanding a whole bunch of stuff in order to do the shoot. And he thinks he's going to get it just because he is Brett Keller. And I love that the studio head is just like, you're fucking joking me, right?
Well, and plus, Brett has always been played as a little too trying too hard to be like powerful guy. Yeah, it's like when he's on the phone with Michael earlier. And he has like his little wired headset on and he's just very meh, 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 meh. And before that, when Ben picked a fight with him about writing and stuff like that, I just don't like this character. I like the idea of the character. I don't like the way that the character is being played. It's just not a believable portrayal, I guess.
Yeah, there's something about it that just screams like, you are supposed to represent Hollywood the way Melanie in the beginning was supposed to represent law.
I feel like this story is just a total dud, though, in the overall series. Like, a comic book made into a superhero big budget movie. That's kind of like reaching. That's outside the weight class of Queer as Folk, I think. And it's just not a Pittsburgh working class gay story that I can really get behind. So I just feel like it's not a great story.
No, I hear what you're saying. I think you have a point of saying that the show jumped the shark a lot earlier than I did, but this was that episode where I thought it really made sense to me that the show was jumping the shark.
Yeah, but last episode we loved last week, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Big fan of that. But like, I hear what you're saying about Justin being in Hollywood to make the film adaptation of his comic book. And the fact that Michael seems like not an essential part of, I mean, he's the co-creator,
he's the author of it, right?
Yeah, like he writes the dialogue, he writes the storylines, like he's a big part of it. But of course, in film, the writers have like the least amount of power. If this was in theater, he would have the most power. But in film, writers have very little power.
I'm afraid to say that season 5 is like a lot more of this, though. We do get Rosie O'Donnell and Cyndi Lauper. Next season.
Excited for that.
Yeah. So for most of the meeting with the studio head, Justin is just kind of like slunk down in his chair, just kind of like admiring Brett going about it. And there's two people that we can, I guess, assume are lawyers in there. And then we have the studio head. Brett is doing Brett. And then all of a sudden, Justin comes to life and like closes the deal by talking about butt sex.
Excuse me, Mr. Fenderman, but our comic book was conceived that way for a reason. Because a lot of the shit that gay people go through is grim. I ought to know, I'm a kid who got his head bashed in. As far as the ass business, getting your butt fucked is one of the great pleasures and privileges of being gay. If you haven't experienced it yourself, I recommend it. As far as Rage is concerned, just because he has no apologies for who he is and no regrets about his life doesn't make him arrogant. It makes him honest and brave. So, despite your concerns, we prefer to be true to our original vision. Rage wouldn't expect anything less.
I think he saw an opportunity because the studio head was making a point about it's too dark. Who believes this kind of stuff happens? And Justin's like, it happened to me, and that's why it's important. And then he's able to then free flow into talking about the honor it is to have your ass fucked, which, preach. And, you know, it was impressive that this 20-year-old kid was able to hold his own in a room that is full of allegedly Hollywood heavy hitters.
I do like these moments when Justin can string together smart presentations of art. Like, we've seen him do it before with that sunglasses woman when he kind of stole the meeting away from Brian.
And Brian was so pissed.
So we often see Justin just kind of like pull this all together out of nowhere. And I like that with Justin because we, unlike the other characters, we never see Justin stray too far away from who we think he is. There was that pink posse thing where we're like confounded by it. But for the most part, the character is what we expect. And he acts the way that we would want him to act, which is good. Too many other characters just all of a sudden are acting wacky and we can't figure out why they're acting wacky. But Justin apparently delivers the goods here, and Rage is going to be made into a feature film directed by Brett Keller using all of the backlot of this studio. Okay. Tops and bottoms for this episode. What's your top, Matt?
My top is something that we kind of glossed over a little bit, but I found it such a wonderful moment. It was Horvath's proposal.
Oh.
I legitimately cried.
What?
Yeah, I did.
He had such terrible timing, though.
I loved it. I loved the timing of it. I thought it was perfect. The fact that it's like he had the, this is where the show doesn't do this for most of their storylines, but did it for this. And I think this is why it paid off for me, is that we have two moments where he's about to do it and backs off because he gets cold feet. And then finally, he's going to
get cold
feet,
though. He got interrupted every time.
No, though, it felt like he could have stood his ground, but he backed down from it too easily. And then here he's finally like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it before she goes. And then finally she brushes him off. He's like, no, I'm going to say what I need to say. I want you to marry me. And the fact that there's that beat for her to then come back and the doors open. Yeah, I found it very moving and I loved it.
I've got two tops. The first is that final scene with Melanie and Lindsay realizing that they were done. The way that Michelle Clooney and Taya Gill played the scene made it seem real and final to me. In a lot of cases, we're left wondering, like, what just happened? But I think these two actors really convinced us that, ooh, they're done. They had reached the end of what they had to give each other, and they didn't have anything left. And once again, we get a really nice lesbian cliffhanger. So that was top number one. My second top was, this one you'll probably hate, but it was the use of the song Fantastic Day by the band Haircut 100 at the end. I thought the Liberty Ride kickoff bike scene was kind of a really poor version of the movie Breaking Away. But but layering a 1980s British new wave song on top of it sold it for me. And I was like, okay, I can get behind this.
Sorry, I love that it's Breaking Away. The poor version of Breaking Away. That's great.
I didn't know that you would know that movie.
Oh, I've seen it. Of course I know it. Any time to see Dennis Quaid in those tight shorts? Yes, please.
Oh, yeah. what was your bottom?
My bottom would be the departure from everything that's going on with the Liberty Ride to then cut to the Rage to Hollywood story. I mean, we talked about it. It's so uninteresting and so fake compared to everything else that's going on for all of our characters, that to have this Hollywood thing happen, or at least the way that it's being presented, doesn't feel truthful the way the other storylines happen. So it doesn't have that grand of an effect on me, even though I think it's a cool thing that their comic book is being adapted for film. Why this comic? Like, is it really this huge hit that the nation has heard of? It feels like maybe not outside of Pittsburgh. So how did this comic book land in the hands of Hollywood? I'm having a hard time going along with that ride.
My bottom was a different ride, and that's called the Liberty Ride. I just can't embrace this story. It's used to weave together many different stories, but 15 years later, it just seems like such a rudimentary plot device to try to stitch all this stuff together. I'm into drama, and the Liberty Ride isn't really all that exciting or meaningful. I don't know why writers of a dramatic series would think that coming up with a fundraising bike ride out in the middle of nowhere would be all that interesting to people. I can think of a number of other gay, lesbian, transgender, questioning, anything else could have told a better story into this particular series. So Liberty Ride, thumbs down. This has been episode 13 of season 4, Proposal of Two Kinds. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, the season 4 finale, a train wreck of an episode where every season 4 storyline is tied up in a bow. Michael and Ben are detained at the U.S. border where they're posing as legally married U.S. citizens. Ted and Emmett get lost in the forest on their way to a 12-step meeting for Ted. Melanie goes into labor. Rage gets the green light, and Brian wipes out on his bike, shattering his collarbone and his dreams of finishing the Liberty Ride. So bring on the melodrama.
Jesus.
I wrote that.
We're going to have a lot to talk about next week. Fresh reviews and ratings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to us are much appreciated, so please take a moment and help us out. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
Find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall if you'd like to connect with me personally. And since my little snarky comment last time, many people have connected with me personally, so thank you. Nobody had until I like whined about it.
And they were like, I'm here too. Yeah. and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. We hope you'll join us next week for a new episode. Still Queer as Folk was made with love in Chicago.